Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217-328-2295. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour and the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And we're going to be having a guest call in who's called in the Labor Hour in the past, John Ryman from Oakland, California. And we're going to be also have Jim Iman here in the studio with us, and we're going to be talking about a word that if you ask 10 people on the street what it means, you're going to get probably at least nine different answers, and that word is socialism. Now, we have to thank John McCain in the 2008 election for actually kind of breaking the ice on this. Remember?
Well, yeah.
I mean, how he accused Obama of being a socialist. I mean, that's the most absurd statement I could ever imagine. But it was funny when he made that statement, all of a sudden it became a topic of conversation and even appeared on the cover of, I think it was, Time magazine at one point. Yeah. So, but anyway, we're going to be talking a little about that. But first, we want to talk a little about what's been happening around the country and around the world as far as worker-related news. So I guess we'll start with you, Bob.
All right. New Orleans union membership is set to double after hotel and casino workers win. Says the number of union members in New Orleans tourism industry is set to double. The Hospitality and Gaming Union Unite Here and Teamsters Local 270 are in contract negotiations with Harrah's Hotel and Casino after winning a card check election among 900 hotel and food workers. According to the Times-Picayune, the local Teamsters Union will represent the 150 so employees who work at the front of the hotel, bellmen, valets, and front desk workers, as well as those in the hotel's warehouse. Unite Here will represent the remaining 750 employees who work in housekeeping and food service. About 70% of the eligible employees expressed interest in union representation during a formal card check held in March, giving the union's legal authority to begin negotiations. With 70,000 tourism-related jobs in the New Orleans area and tourism accounting for almost $6.5 billion of New Orleans economy, unions have ample opportunity to expand in New Orleans. Unite Here currently has only 3 contracts in the city, and as we're well aware, unions are not very well liked in the South. You know, so
indeed,
any inroads in the South is always something worthwhile to see.
Mm-hmm.
You can contrast this to what's been happening actually in Atlantic City, where 4 of the 12 casinos have closed down this year. The last one in September, they're talking about just having to process approximately 5,000 newly laid off workers within 3 days, you know, at the unemployment office there. So they said, their union, Local 54 of Unite Here, helps displaced workers file for unemployment and give them information on signing up for health insurance and other benefits. It says, They'll be down to 8 casinos. Almost 8,000 people will be out of work. They one time had 32,000 jobs in the casinos there.
Wow.
And it's just a mark of how that casino industry, at least in Atlantic City, is shutting down because of increased competition from all the other states and, and whatnot. Now, some of the people are doing, you know, going along with it, but Mr. Trump himself had a lawsuit and it actually got turned down by the judge on Friday. Trump loses his bid to end pension payments at the casino. So Trump at the Taj Mahal failed on Friday to get approval from the U.S. bankruptcy judge to end payments to the casino's union pension fund, which had been a key condition for a Carl Icahn-backed deal to rescue the gambling complex in Atlantic City. So U.S. bankruptcy judge Kevin Gross in Wilmington, Delaware, said he lacked the authority to allow Trump Entertainment Resorts, the bankrupt owner Taj Mahal, to reject a portion of its collective bargaining agreement, or CBA. So, but the judge Gross said he would consider a request by the company to reject the entire CBA, including the need to make pension payments, in another hearing on October 14th. So this is how they want to rescue things, is by ending pension payments.
Yeah, indeed.
You know, screwing the workers in the end. You know?
Yep, so, indeed. Yeah, I think that's kind of a mistake. I mean, it's good that they won. I mean, 900 some jobs, you know, new workers organized in New Orleans, but I think that should have been all one union. Don't you, Jim?
Yes.
Because you know what happens usually, that you'll have a problem with one and then they'll go out on strike and the other ones will be obligated under contractual law and their union leadership to told to cross a picket line. Otherwise, their union will be sued, you know. Where if you have one union in one workplace, you don't have that problem, you know. So, okay, I got a story here, which is pretty close to home here. It's actually up in the Chicago area. This is from Northern Illinois Jobs of Justice. That mechanics at Piedmont Chevrolet have been on strike since July 9th of this year. They are a newly organized union, members of the International Association of Machinists Local 701. They seek a fair contract on par with that of mechanics at other Piedmont dealerships and that of mechanics at auto dealerships all over Chicagoland. Instead, management has offered a subpar deal with low wages and benefits. The union has offered some concessions, but they have been met with utter intransigency. In fact, management has attempted in several ways to restrict the strikers' federally protected rights to picket. And you can get more information about this at www.goiam.org. And you can also help by calling today to the owner of Al Piedmont Chevrolet. Her name's Rosanna Piedmont at 630-217-7008. That's 630-217-7008. And it says here, to be polite but firm. I say, forget polite, be firm. And tell her that you live in the community and that you have seen her workers out on the strike line, that you want to see them treated with the dignity and justice they deserve. Or you can simply say that you have heard about their plight and sympathize with them. Tell her that you will not patronize her dealership until she offers them a fair union contract, and tell her how you will be telling your family and friends to do so likewise. So, do you have anything else, Bob?
I've got one.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
For 2 weeks, the French pilots have been on strike.
Oh, really? With Air France?
Air France. Mm-hmm. They're back to work, but now the German pilots are on strike.
That'd be Lufthansa then. Okay.
So, Lufthansa. So, we'll see how that works out.
Interesting.
How did they do? I mean, they get what they wanted?
Yes.
Isn't it amazing? You know, it seems like in Europe when workers go on strike, they pretty much get what they want. And here we just hear about one concessionary contract after another.
Yep.
But I guess this would fall under news stories. This week I went to two interesting events here in town. Tuesday night I went to Salem Baptist Church. There was a forum on the minimum wage. It's interesting because well, there seems to be, you know, remember, it seems like the Democratic Party, of course, is pushing for $10.10 an hour. And even though the demand has been 15 all over the country. And so this seems to be what they're really trying to push is this 10.10 an hour. I mean, ever since Barack Obama came out and said it, I guess they're all, you know, kowtowing and falling in line with the party line, basically. You know, let's not be too hard on our corporate contributors. Let's take a little of the air out of the sails of this movement and offer them, you know, throw them a few crumbs, so to speak, you know. So there were some people that spoke out, you know, and saying 10.10's not enough. It's got to be 15, you know, because at least if you demand 15 and you fight hard enough, you might get 12 or 13 at least. You go and ask it for $10.10, you're going to be lucky to get $9 an hour here in the state of Illinois.
It should be more than that.
It should be more than that.
Labor productivity has never been higher than it is today. And if you put that in there, it should be about $22.50 an hour.
Yes, based on productivity.
Yeah.
If it was based just on cost of living, it'd be probably more like about $17. But it should be based on productivity. You're absolutely right, Jim. The other event I went to was next door at Mike and Molly's bar Thursday night. There was a little debate between Democratic State Rep candidate Carol Ammons and her Republican opponent, Christine Williamson. Very interesting because basically the Republican Christine Williamson pretty much agreed with everything Carol's positions were. And, in fact, at one point Carol Ammons said, gee, if you're going to agree with everything I said, why you run as a Republican?
Was the response to that?
Nothing. only difference was, frankly, was that Christine Williamson refused to state what she thought the minimum wage should be. She kept talking about how she supports living wages, but even though she was asked three times by the moderator, and in fact the question in the very beginning was worded to say that we want a specific number from both of you of what you think the minimum wage should be, and Carol Ammons came out right away and said that it should be $17 an hour, but maybe we should start at $10.10, definitely start at $10.10 and index it up to $17 an hour over time, where Kristen Williams refused to state any kind of number on living as far as what she thought it should be, just making some generalist sort of statements that, she worked a minimum wage job once, she knows it's hard, but that we also don't want to drive businesses out of Illinois, so,
If you can't give a worker a living wage, you don't deserve to be in business.
Well, that's true. I mean, I agree. It's part of the cost of doing business.
Let them fold up.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting.
The working class can take over and do the job themselves.
Yeah. But, that's right. That's one thing, too. Workers' cooperatives are actually growing phenomenally. I should have brought that article in today. It fits right in. But, yes, more and more workers' cooperatives are being formed all over the country. And workers get higher wages. The product it's better quality product, and it's usually a lower price, too, than what it was previously or their corporate competitors. But, it was interesting that the Living Wage Forum at Salem Baptist Churches was one young woman who stood up, who said she was from Chicago, that said she is a director of a small nonprofit, and that if the minimum wage goes up to $10.10 an hour, just $10.10 an hour, that she's going to have to lay off a couple of people. And I stood up and said, the thing is that this argument is going to always be used regardless, and I was kind of, I was trying to be nice and everything, so I didn't really go into the fact that, if you're running, I should have said, how much money are you making a year? That should have been my first question to her, but,
hindsight.
Yeah, hindsight for sure. But anyway, okay, tell you what, we're going to wait for our caller, John Ryman, who's going to be calling in and talking with us about trying to define here what socialism is as well as what capitalism is. And John Ryman's been on the show before. He was here once in person back in fall of 2008. And he's written several pamphlet booklets over the years. One is called What is Socialism? He also wrote another booklet pamphlet called Capitalism's Perfect Storm about the effects of capitalism on our current climate crisis. He also wrote another one called What Happened to Our Unions? About how the unions in the United States have become less and less accountable to their members over time and why. And he also wrote a book called Zionism and Israel, the Apartheid State, in which he goes into a history of Zionism and the adverse effects of that in the current situation in Israel / Palestine. Okay, we're going to take a little quick music break here, and we will be right back. So stay tuned. You listen to the World Labor Hour on WFT Radio. And remember, folks, we're still in Pledge Drive. And you can help keep us on the air by calling in at 217-359-3998.
9338.
Thank you.
Let's try that again.
Okay, let's try this again.
217-359-9338. And we'd appreciate any calls.
That's correct. Thank you, Bob.
Go to the website at weft.org.
Okay.
And,
All right. We'll be right back.
Of Tijuana, filled with garbage and stones, in the streets and in the fields, cursed. frozen, crushed beneath the wheels. Together we are strong. Our songs echo in the darkness. Down the Maquiladora's halls, where Brother Solomon was tortured, one tree in the orchard cast a shadow on the wall. Is hard and long, but the dogs are coming home. We are the dogs of Tijuana, left with dead in the ravine, in the arroyos, in the valleys, the sewers and the alleys. We shiver and we dream, so don't stop to ask directions. You think you lost your way? The wrath of the lion is the wisdom of God, and every dog has its day.
Okay, we're back. That was Tom Morello. Tom Morello with Dogs of Tijuana, and you're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener supported community radio station WFT. And you know, you're not going to hear any public affairs program like the World Labor Hour or Higher Ground or News from Neptune or any of these on corporate radio. That's why we have to ask you twice a year to call in and you know, send us a little money our way so we can, you know, stay on the air, because unfortunately it does cost money, to mainly for electricity and heat and air conditioning, of course, in the summer. Those are our major expenses, but it is expensive, you know, and there's other things that break down occasionally that need to be repaired and all that. So please help keep WFT on the air, both for its unique public affairs program and its unique music genre program. So you can do that by you know, calling today and make a pledge of any amount at 217-359-9338.
There you go.
Okay.
I was checking out this PSA here.
Okay.
This is interesting.
Okay. Well, so public service announcements here real quick. The wars grind on, and in the service not of peace and democracy, but of wealth and power. If you're as weary of them as we are, please come by for a while and demonstrate against them with us today at 2 to 4 p.m. at the corner of Main and Neal in downtown Champaign. We'll have some signs, or bring your own. Given our administration's enthusiastic return to attacking Iraq and, oh yes, Syria, this time bombing the same people we were assisting last year, some of whom are now part of the same ISIS we're now at an undeclared war with in Iraq, we could use some new signs. It'll be interesting to see how the people of CU react to them. So come out today between 2 and 4, downtown Champaign, the corner of Main and Neal. And if you'd like to join us, we'll be meeting at the Esquire from 1 to 2 right before the demonstration there today at 2 o'clock. And let's see here. Immigrant Welcome Awards Ceremony will take place today, October 4th at 2 p.m. at the Urbana Lake House at 206 West Park Street in Urbana, Crystal Lake Park. The Immigrant Welcome Awards recognize the contributions of individuals and organizations that have created a welcoming atmosphere for immigrants in the Champaign-Urbana community. Come to this award ceremony and stay for music, refreshments, and the company of our award winners. Tune in today for another sports show from 2 to 3 on 104.5 WRFU, hosted by fellow worker Neil Parthen. And tune in tomorrow on Comcast Channel 6 for Labor's Worldview TV. And that's on every Sunday from 4 to 5. And this Sunday will be part of a series about the history of the city of Milwaukee. And this Sunday and next Sunday will be the segments dealing with the socialist mayor and city council of Milwaukee that was basically, you know, in city government for, what, 60 years, Jim, more or less?
Frank Zeiler.
Well,
was the last one.
He was the last one, yeah, and I think he retired in 1982, but they originally got elected in sometime in the 19-teens. Was that correct? Okay.
Well, no. Emil Zeidel goes back to the 1890s.
To the 1890s, okay. So
he was the first.
Okay.
But at that point, it was called the Social Democratic Party of Milwaukee.
Uh-huh.
And immediately, Carl Sandburg packed his bags and headed for Milwaukee.
Really?
And he was a lieutenant in the party that was very close to Emil Zeidel. But the head of the party itself was Victor Berger.
Okay.
But Emil Zeidel was the mayor. And, yeah, he and Sandberg were very close and worked together on a lot of things, besides being an investigative reporter for the Socialist Leader.
Okay.
Which was the leading daily newspaper all the way up to the Second World War.
Wow, interesting. I know a little bit of history. It's funny because once the Socialists won majority of the city council and the mayor, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, who are supposed to be such hated rivals against each other, joined forces and basically ran a candidate to try to a series of candidates to try to vote the Socialists out of office. And it's interesting because during their tenure, they really helped the standard of living and the quality of life in Milwaukee significantly by creating parks, you know, a very well-functioning storm drain and sewer system, as well as, you know, cleaning up environmental waste, ending, I mean, crime rate went down, basically contracting out from the city for certain services and repairs was basically done directly by city workers as opposed to the old system where it was, you know, given out to political cronies who were contractors, and yeah, they did a lot to really improve the conditions in
they
in
came
Milwaukee.
From all over the country to study it. It was that advanced.
Yeah. Okay, also continue with some public service announcements here. Peace along with Don't Shoot Coalition, Organization of Black Struggle, Missourian Organizing for Reform and Empowerment, Hands Up United, and ColorOfChange.org and others in a broad effort to launch a weekend of resistance in Ferguson, Missouri, coming up on October 10th to the 13th. That's next weekend. Thousands have already committed, and we expect many more. Census killing of Mike Brown is a movement, moment for racial justice and an opportunity to advance economic and social justice for all. We in the peace movement have a special role to play in the struggle because our work is global, our work is for peace at home and abroad, and we know that war and militarism has no borders. If we are to have peace abroad, we must confront injustice, violence, and the militarization of police in our own communities. And Bob, you've got an interesting public service announcement. I thought I'd leave the best for last here.
There you go. Yeah. You're mentioning that we're in Pledge Drive, and we are having a fundraiser. So WEFD is actually hosting a film screening of Shadows of Liberty at the Art Theater Co-op in downtown Champaign. That's happening on Tuesday, October 7th at 7:30 p.m. It's an internationally acclaimed documentary, and it reveals the extraordinary truth behind corporate-controlled media through highly revealing stories of censorship and cover-ups. So Shadows of Liberty is dedicated to the journalists and information freedom fighters who devote their lives to our right to freedom of information, the central pillar of our society. So Shadows of Liberty features some of these people: Danny Glover, Julian Assange, Dan Rather, Amy Goodman, David Simon, Dick Gregory, Janine Jackson, Daniel Ellsberg, Bob Baer, and Robert McChesney. So a lot of worthwhile information coming from that. That's going on again Tuesday, October 7th at 7:30 at the Art Theater. It's presented by Doc Factory and WEFT, and it's a fundraiser for us. And you can get your tickets online at brownpapertickets.com, or you can go to the Art Theater and get your tickets. Interesting movie going to be there.
Yes, indeed. I'm going to definitely turn out for that one. So, okay, Jim, listen, before John Ryman calls in, why don't we start the topic today about what socialism is by starting to define what's capitalism? I mean, because there's another word that I think has a lot of misconceptions behind it. Because some people think capitalism means somebody has a small business or somebody that's self-employed.
Before that, I want to get back to Victor Berger, who was head of the Social Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
When Debs failed in the Pullman strike, he was put in jail.
Eugene Debs, the railroad workers' union.
Right, organizer of the ARU, the American Railway Union, the first industrial union in America.
Mm-hmm.
And Berger went down and visited him at the McHenry County Jail as often as he could. He brought him books by Marx and Kautsky and Engels, et cetera, and actually converted Debs into a socialist. We have to give Victor Berger credit for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked Kautsky the best of all.
Mm-hmm. Now, previously, Eugene Debs, besides being a labor National Labor Union leader, the railroad workers, also was a two-term state rep, I believe, in the Indiana legislature?
Well, either one or two, I'm not sure. I think it was just one.
That's all he could stomach, right?
Right. He knew there was something wrong with bad news.
Yeah. And with, anyway, so, what would you define, I mean, what is capitalism? I mean, cause there seems to be a lot of almost as much misconception about what that means as socialism.
All right. Capitalism as we know it came into existence with the Industrial Revolution.
Okay.
Which could only happen because of the overthrow of the aristocracy.
Of the nobility
right, because otherwise there were just guilds.
That was a feudalism.
Under feudalism.
Mm-hmm.
But after with the Industrial Revolution here began with Eli Whitney's cotton gin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was
but it started in Europe earlier.
Basically Britain, mm-hmm. you know, and the invention of
steam power.
Steam power, mm-hmm. yeah. So
but today, what is, if somebody says
So anyway, capitalism comes into existence somewhat slowly,
mm-hmm.
but with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, it speeded up.
Okay.
Now, what's important here is that in order to make a profit, you have what's known as surplus value. For whatever you're paid, has to be worth a lot more, in order for the capitalist to make a profit, the owner of the company.
You mean a lot less? You have to be paid a lot less than what the product actually is worth.
Sorry, I said it the other way around. Yeah, right.
Okay.
So that's the job of the unions, was to keep raising those wages to keep in, you know, so they could buy, have a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, the unions were really powerful in this country. And I know when I was in high school, you could graduate from Boys Technical High School and become a journeyman in several different crafts,
mm-hmm.
and raise a family. And
okay. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. This is John calling. How are you doing?
Good, John. We have Jim Iman in the studio, along with myself and Bob Plesney. And right before you rang the phone here, I was asking Jim that we thought we might start out with what the definition of capitalism is, because frankly,
right.
I think there's as much misunderstanding about that as there is socialism. I thought that might be a good start to, before we go into kind of talking about what is socialism, really.
Right. Okay. So, I think, you know, the best way to look at it is to understand it is to look at it historically.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was trying to do.
Yeah, and Jim was kind of going into it historically and kind of led up to where, you know, after sort of the capitalist system was fully developed through the Industrial Revolution, that then the union movement came along and was able to get a little bit more for its workers, but basically taking away a little more of the surplus value from the capitalist class.
Right. And in reality, there's always been what you call surplus value. In other words, capitalism is not the first form of class society as we know.
Mm-hmm.
There was the slave system and feudalism, and each of those systems, there was a mass of people who produced the goods that society needed to survive. Those were the workers, whether they were the serfs in feudalism or the slaves under a slave system. And the owners of the means of production, that is to say, in those cases, the owners of the land, they creamed off a big bulk of what those workers produced for themselves. So the workers produced more than they needed for their own survival. That was the surplus value.
Mm-hmm.
And now the difference, one big difference, was that under capitalism, the workers themselves are, quote, free. As I think it was Bertolt Brecht said, what that freedom really means, he said that under capitalism, even the capitalist has the freedom to sleep underneath the bridge.
Okay. As opposed to feudalism or a slavery plantation system, to where
under feudalism the worker was tied to the land.
In other words, they couldn't, if they tried to leave, they'd be punished, possibly even killed.
Right, in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing is that under all those different systems, the means of production, whether they'd just be a plot of land, however big or small, or whether it be a modern factory, the means of production are owned by a relative handful of people, and other people work those means of production. They sell their own ability to work to the owners of the means of production, whether it be the capitalist or the slave owner. And make no mistake about it, even the slave, in a sense, got paid in that, you know, when the hog that he or she raised was killed, they got the ears, the hoofs, and so on in order to survive.
Chitlins.
Mm-hmm. Right. But under capitalism, it's a slightly more complex way of the worker being paid. They would get paid, or they do get paid on an hourly basis or a daily or a weekly basis. They get, but what they're getting is a percentage of the wealth that they create.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so we're going from chattel slavery to wage slavery.
Exactly.
And there's a kind of a nebulous period there in between, but we're still wage slaves.
Right, because
and most people,
at the end of the day, you basically get paid enough, just enough, to come back the next day or the next week and start that round all over again, plus a little bit extra to raise the next generation of little wage slaves.
Okay. You know, I was mentioning some of your book pamphlets that you published over the years, and the one I brought today, of course, is the one titled What is Socialism? Question mark. And I thought, you know, there was a great little part here in this book about, I'd say a little more than halfway through, in which you have a kind of a chapter here called Society Based on Cooperation versus Competition. And you kind of give an analogy of how human beings are not naturally competitive and greedy. That you basically gave the example of the American Indians or other, more ancient societies and stuff, of how there was cooperation and not competition.
Well, you know, people today, they look around them, and they see all the greed, selfishness, egoism, careerism, and plus, they see that. And then on the other hand, that part is constantly reinforced on television, through the media, and all kinds of different ways that this is errant in human nature. And so most people think, if it ever comes up, we're told, well, that's how society has to be. It has to be run based on competition. But
okay,
if
John,
you look,
would you agree that the exploitation is actually the accumulation of surplus value? It's an economic term where oppression is physical.
Well, right. Of course, if I'm constantly ripping you off, and what I have to do at the same time is make sure that you don't rebel against that. That's the oppression. But the other point is, as far as a society based on cooperation, on the one hand, we always, we never hear about the fact, or almost never hear about the fact, the majority of human history was pre-class societies. You know, basically tribal societies. And those societies were based on cooperation. And in fact, if you think about how the human species came to dominate the planet, you know, we can't run very fast, we can't fly, we're not very strong, but we can cooperate, we can work together like no other species. And that is the secret for our advancement. And in fact, modern research into, you know, recent research into how the brain functions and how hormones regulate the functioning of the human organism have shown, in fact, that empathy and cooperation and working together is inherent in our own biological makeup, as it is, incidentally, in all species. So it's just simply a lie put forward by those who are exploiting our labor and keeping their boot on our neck that it's impossible to run a society based on cooperation. That is to say, based on what's needed by the overwhelming majority in society, and we should add now also what's needed by the planet itself.
Yes, indeed. Which I mentioned earlier, your book, Capitalism's Perfect Storm, in which you, kind of focus in on, horrible effects capitalism has had on what's causing our current climate crisis.
Right.
Okay. You know, it's also mentioned here in your book about, you mentioned that in 2000, there were some 19,622 corporations which had assets of $50 million or more. And, you state that, these giant corporations and the one just below them, you know, the ones with only $10 million or so, or $25 million, actually constitute a dictatorship over our society, even though you hear all the time that we're actually a democracy. But you go on to say that that is because they determine whether you will have a job or not, whether you will be able to pay the rent, buy groceries, and send your kids to school. They determine what entertainment news you see on TV. They determine what will be in your food you eat, and the air you breathe, and the water you drink. And they all but determine who will be the next president, and then determine what his or her policies will be. I think that's a really good summation of sort of the problem we're at right now, and have been for a while.
You know, I was just reading in Colorado, where there's a big movement against fracking,
yes,
which is destroying people's health, destroying the air they breathe, the water they drink, and so on. And in one town, they voted to ban fracking. That is to say, they decided to, they made a democratic decision about what kind of water they were going to drink and what kind of air they were going to breathe. And so what happened was the frackers, that is to say the oil companies, took that vote to court, and the courts threw the vote out.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't have a better example of how the giant corporations not only determine whether or not you're going to have a job, but determine what kind of air you're going to breathe and what kind of water you're going to drink.
Mm-hmm. Now, was it Mussolini that said that his definition of fascism was the merger of the corporate sector and the government sector?
He
said, and I have this in the only book that he wrote, the Theory and Social Practice of Fascism. Fascism comes into existence when you cannot put a tissue paper between corporate interests and state interests. So Mussolini abolished the parliament and put in the CEOs of all the corporations in Italy.
As representatives in the parliament.
Representatives,
yeah,
of the people.
Yeah. I don't mean to transgress on that, but I mean, there is a, considering the situation we have today, I mean, we're going from, it seems like capitalism is kind of changing, from what it was maybe, decades ago into more of, almost a new form of feudalism or almost fascism. I mean, it seems like it's getting more vicious and,
I mean, in some ways true, but let's not romanticize what capitalism in the United States was back in its golden era, say, 100 years or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
When you read books like The Robber Barons, you can see, they directly control the state legislatures in some ways even more directly than they do now.
Mm-hmm.
So, capitalist democracy, you have some radical reformers like Naomi Klein, despite all the good information she puts out there, and people like that who say, it's just this form of capitalism. Well, no, this form of capitalism is just a slightly changed variation of what it's always been.
Mm-hmm.
And but I don't think it's accurate to say that what we have today is fascism. Just take one point. If we had fascism today, you and I would not be talking on the radio.
Yes.
So,
yes, but I guess what I'm getting at is that it seems like the ruling class is getting more and more confident. I mean, it's almost getting to the point that they used to be a lot more, it seems like, in past decades, to where they had to be a little bit more, with a happy face and stuff. Now, it seems like they're doing such things like you just mentioned about the judiciary, basically, and this is not the only case. Just this week, I've heard of other cases where the judiciary has just, blatantly ruled in favor of corporate interests, to where they're kind of come to an attitude of, screw you, what are you going to do about it? This is what we're going to do, and we don't care what you want, speaking to the majority of the people.
Well, let's call it creeping fascism. Or let's call it neo-fascism, fascism with a smiley face.
Well, you know, you can't have fascism with a smiley face.
Okay. Okay, we've kind of transgressed here a little bit. I think maybe now we can go into what is socialism? I mean, you ask 10 people in the street, you're going to get at least 9 different answers, and I've even had some people think that, and this is kind of why I brought this up, some people think that socialism is fascism because of the term of the Hitler's Nazi Party, the National Socialist Party.
Right. Well, I just want to make one point.
Sure.
About, you know, what you were saying about the court rulings and so on, and that is that the class struggle always goes through its ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the working class movement is at a lull.
Correct.
And so that gives the owners of big business, the capitalist class, that gives them, increased confidence to go on to the offensive, and they do it on all realms, through the courts and politics, on the job and so on.
The militarization of the police force,
the
national security state that we have, the NSA, surveilling everybody. They know at some point that the proletariat in the United States is
the working
going
class
to rise up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're taking all these precautions, and they're oppressing us more and more and more. And
but to get back to that question of what is socialism,
mm-hmm.
you know, there was that Pew Research poll came out about a year or so ago that showed amongst young adults, 18 to 29 years old, that a higher percentage of them had a positive view of socialism, 49%,
mm-hmm.
had a positive view of capitalism, 46%. And incidentally, 47% of young adults had a negative view of capitalism. But I do think that, as your question implies, you know, that it's really important for us to have an understanding of what socialism is.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people, when they think of socialism, they think of what you have in Denmark or Sweden or something mm-hmm. like that.
Uh-huh.
That is capitalism with a smiley face.
Okay. But it's becoming more of a frown, even in Sweden.
Because I think that there's a couple of fundamentals for capitalism versus socialism. And the first one is, who owns the means of production?
Okay.
And we're not talking about every little mom and pop grocery store or every little startup, but we're talking about like Microsoft, General Motors, the banks, the big corporate-owned supermarkets, and so on. Who owns them?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the first thing. And what we would say is that it has to be owned by society as a whole. That is to say, collectively owned. Because you can't control what you don't own,
mm-hmm.
especially nowadays. When with the push of a button on the computer, you can send hundreds of millions of dollars all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be owned collectively, and that implies then to me that the only way that it can be owned, you cannot own and control it on a, you know, just these workers here own this factory and those workers there own that factory. It can't work like that because the other part of what's necessary is economic planning. And that's more important today than ever before when you
correct, John.
To account the environmental crisis. And you have to have a central plan to deal with the environmental crisis. And so what that means is that all the different aspects of the economy have to be integrated together to deal with that crisis, and to have a plan to deal with that crisis and the development of the economy as a whole. And
John, would you not say that the maximum program for revolutionary social democracy, or socialism if you prefer, is to have a classless society? I think we agree with the anarchists on that. It's a matter of
But where we disagree with them, or where I disagree with them, is you can't go from 0 to 100 miles an hour just right off the bat. And
of course,
that regardless of what we might want, that classes And a lot of the hangovers of capitalism are not going to disappear just overnight. And so I think that you do have to have some form of a state. That is to say, the collective, organized control of, by, and for the working class over society as a whole.
Now, you mentioned Workers' Council as sort of being part of that, of how that, the nuts and bolts of how that would work. Do you want to talk a little about that?
So what that means is that in every workplace, the workers would meet together on paid time and elect their own representatives who would be paid exactly the same, would be paid the same as the average worker there, and who would be subject to recall at any time. And those elected representatives from each different workplace would meet together, and they would form like a local workers' council. And then from those local workers' councils, then a national, and in fact nowadays you'd have to have an international workers' council, would develop all on the same basis, including being subject to recall and so on. And that would be the basis of the state. Now, one thing I think that's really critically important and is the, and then that state then would hire the technical experts, engineers, physicists, and environmental scientists and so on, to develop a plan for the economy. But that plan isn't something, now the way they did it in the Soviet Union with that privileged elite was that it was a bureaucracy cut off from the working class that developed that plan and then just imposed it on society as a whole.
Well, that wasn't at first under Stalin.
No, that wasn't not at first, but that was...
Yeah, right, because it was a worker state.
Right, and if we have another 2 hours, we can discuss how and why that happened.
Sure.
But, you know, that the revolution got sidetracked. But anyway, that plan would have to be brought back to the working class would have to, the workers themselves in the different workplaces would also have to be involved in the dialogue to discussing that plan, and then as the plan evolves, be directly involved in discussing, well, what does this mean for us? Can we meet these goals? Do we want higher goals or lower goals, and so on, so that at each step of the way, the workers themselves, not just with their desires and wishes, but also with their collective knowledge and understanding of the productive process, that they would be directly involved in all of that. And, of course, when you have a privileged bureaucracy that can't involve the workers, because that means that the first thing the workers are going to say is your privileges are over with. So, and also with the internet, social media, and so on, it would be a million times easier today than ever before in history for the working class to be directly involved in that plan. But you still have to have some centralizing force to bring everything together so it doesn't just fly all apart, really, like it does under capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Now, I remember when you actually here in Champaign-Urbana were on the program back in the fall of 2008, right after the financial collapse, you were advocating at that point that these banks that were getting these big bailouts or were basically promised, at that point, were being promised a bailout, despite the objections of probably over 90% of the population initially, that you advocated basically that the government take over the banks and basically have it set up a system to where they were basically society owned as opposed to corporate or individually owned.
Right. And of course that would be a step in the direction of what we're advocating, but it could never really be fully carried out without a total social revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, John. Marx even said that at the beginning of the bourgeois democratic revolution that the working class itself is the only class capable of fulfilling the bourgeois democratic revolution. And we haven't, we're going in the wrong direction. We're getting closer and closer to, you know, being a fascist. You know, it's creeping fascism and it's pretty scary stuff, and I don't see much resistance, even though you're right about the figures that nearly a majority or half of the youth, you know, think socialism's a good idea. And that's grounds for being hopeful, but who's going to do the organizing?
It's true. We are in a lull in the class struggle, at least as far as our side fighting back, although you look at stuff like what's going on in Ferguson, which you just mentioned before I called in, you know, and from what I understand, they're still having protests every single night.
That's right.
There. But one big issue is the role of the union leadership, who just simply rule out, just as a book sealed with seven seals, they rule out the idea of any sort of society that's organized around anything different from what we have. And they say, you know, look, we need the capitalists, there's no alternative to them, and we have to help them make a profit. And because of the crisis in the capitalist system itself, you know, that means that you workers, members of my union, that you're going to have to live worse next year than you're living this year, and your kids will have to live even worse. And they do everything that they can to demoralize any sector of their membership that wants to fight back.
Now, that wasn't always the case. I mean, the early trade union movement in this country, a lot of the leadership were like socialists and anarchists. They were basically, at that point, we're talking a period of like the 1880s, 1890s, to where they basically were, their plan was to eventually completely, like say in the construction trades, make it to where there were no longer any private contractors, but that were the union members working out of the hall would do all the construction work directly for whoever was needing houses or buildings built. But that's changed at some point.
The first craft union in the United States was Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, which was started by a banker as a benevolent society and insurance. So they have, if they were killed or injured on the job, they'd have some insurance.
I see.
And they were referred to at that time as the aristocracy of labor.
But John, you mentioned that, you know, in your pamphlet, one of your other booklet pamphlets, What Happened to Our Unions, and you make that point real clear, that you just mentioned and everything. So you basically think that, and you know, I'm going to lead up to a little controversy here, okay? A couple weeks ago, we had the socialist Seattle City Council member Kashama Sawant call into the show, and
right.
I know that, you know, when she was running for election, you were a big supporter of hers. Sent out information, you know, support for her, and you even sent her a pretty good chunk of money. But
right.
After she got elected, you had certain differences with her, and what were those?
Well, for one thing, I think Sawant and her group, Socialist Alternatives, have gotten much too close to this same layer of union leadership that we're talking about. I mean, if you just take one small example, is that at the Seattle-Tacoma airport area, where they passed the $15 an hour minimum wage initiative, and part of that initiative, though, which was pushed through by the union leadership, part of that initiative, though, was that union workers at the airport would be excluded from it. That
from the $15 minimum wage, okay.
Yeah, if you were an employer that had a union contract and the contract called for less than $15 an hour, you wouldn't have to pay the $15 an hour. And in fact, when they had the conference for 15 now back in April, the hotel workers union leadership came to that conference and requested the same thing. They came there really on behalf of their employers, the hotel owners, and asked for the same thing for 15 now. And in other words, that the unionized hotels would be excluded from a $15 an hour minimum wage ordinance. And in the case of SeaTac, neither Sawant nor Socialist Alternative had any criticism of that. And in the case of the hotels in Seattle, they all supported that. They supported excluding unionized hotel workers for that. Now just think about if you were the average union member and you saw that because you were a union member, you were actually getting paid less. How would that make you feel about union membership?
I'd drop out of the union myself.
I mean, I know.
Sometimes and, you can't, though, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is, that is the sort of thing which I think has been, you know, I think it's a serious, serious mistake on their part, and they just, they do not recognize the huge gap that's opened up between the membership and the leadership of the union. Just, if I could give one example, years ago I was handing out a leaflet against Bush's invasion of Iraq, and I got to talking to a union worker who agreed with the leaflet, and he said, look, the unions, but we got to talking about the unions, and he said, the unions are all corrupt, and if you tell me that they're not, I'm going to take your leaflet and throw it in the trash.
Wow.
Well, we're not going to have to wait too long, because I think there's going to be an international currency collapse.
Well, there may be, but I mean, my point is, as
12
far as
18 months,
as far as the want and socialist alternative, I mean, that was a big step forward to get an open socialist elected to public office. But every step forward comes with certain responsibilities, and part of that responsibility, I think, is to help union members organize to fight to change their unions, and they're doing just the opposite, I have to say. And the other thing is, I mean, just look at, like, in some ways, the center of the fight back in this country right now is Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, where have all the socialist groups been? I went back there on my own, and you had different individual socialists go back there, but as far as an organized presence, which they wouldn't know what to do even if they were there, but I mean, where have they been on this issue of the mass incarceration of black people and Latino people? The just almost seems like daily blatant murders by police of black and Latino youth. I mean, where have they been on these issues?
Russia Today's coverage of Ferguson, they interviewed Carl Dix. He's the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which used to be Workers' World.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very articulate, black guy.
Yeah, I mean, there might be one or two here and there, but, I mean, if you can't fight against, can't do what you can to help the struggle against this sort of oppression, you know, then, then you're not worthy of the name socialist, in my opinion.
Okay. Would you agree with a simplistic definition of socialism as both economic and political democracy?
Yeah, but, you know, when... yes, but, I mean, in the sense that, you know, that whole thing about democracy is so...
tainted, yeah.
Misrepresented in so many ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, just... the name of one particular group, the National Endowment for Democracy.
Oh, my God, yeah. Well,
see what I mean, which is a CIA front.
Sure.
Sure it is.
And look at National Socialist Party, like what Hitler used. I mean, you know, that's the thing. People always, you know, like opportunists always twist words to, you know, for their own opportunistic ends.
Well, I mean, I think that what you, the way I would define socialism is, number one, the collective ownership of the means of the commanding heights of the economy, the mm-hmm. major means of production, and number two, a worker-run society that is run through where the workers run society through a worker's state, a state that is run of, by, and for the working class itself.
Mm-hmm. Where they
and
vote? Where they vote?
Mm-hmm. Democratically planned economy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, economic planning is impossible under capitalism.
Yeah. Even though it's interesting what the Chinese have done, how they've kind of mixed the worst aspects of capitalism and, you know, communism, so to speak. But right. They have done a lot of economic planning, and it's worked for them. I mean, everything from high-speed rail to, you know, a lot of different things, you know, that we should be doing here. John, we ran out of time. Thank you so much for calling in. And I just want to again mention some of your little booklets that are available, What is Socialism, Capitalism's Perfect Storm, and What Happened to Our Unions, and how can listeners find out more, including your blog site?
If they go to OaklandSocialist.com, that's OaklandSocialist.com, and click on the right under pamphlets. They can find all those pamphlets and others.
Okay, John. Well, thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye now.
Oh, yes, Jim.
I just like to say it's always a pleasure talking to John Ryman, and I wish I could talk to him more. And the only solution is revolution.
Okay. All right. So you've been listening to World Labor Hour on Listener Support Community Radio Station, WFT in Champaign. And if you haven't made your pledge to help keep us on the air, please call in at 217-359-9338. You are not going to hear a radio show that's corporate-owned talk about this topic at all, or a lot of other topics and guests that we have in here on a weekly basis. So anyway, until next week, be safe and power to the people, and stay tuned for the Union Edge. Take care.